I don't cover discrimination by everyone for every type of housing. But I had no chance from the start, and everyone in Congress knew it. The compromise was painfully worked out in the House Judiciary Committee. In Los Angeles today, comedian Lenny Bruce died of what was believed to be an overdose of narcotics. Bruce was 42 years old. Dr. Martin Luther King says he does not intend to cancel plans for an open housing March Sunday into the Chicago suburb of Cicero. Cook County Sheriff Richard Ogilvie asked King to call off the march, and the police in Cicero said they would ask the National Guard be called out if it is held. King, now in Atlanta, Georgia, plans to return to Chicago Tuesday. In Chicago, Richard Speck, accused murderer of 9 student nurses, was brought before a grand jury today for indictment. The nurses were found stabbed and strangled in their Chicago apartment. In Washington, the atmosphere was tense today as a special subcommittee of the House Committee on Un-American Activities continued its probe into anti-Vietnam War protests. Demonstrators were forcibly evicted from the hearings when they began chanting anti-war slogans. Former Vice President Richard Nixon says that unless there is a substantial increase in the present war effort in Vietnam, the U.S. should look forward to 5 more years of war. In a speech before the Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in New York, Nixon also said opposition to the war in this country is the greatest single weapon working against the U.S. That's the 7 o'clock edition of the news. Good night.
Hi, I'm Eiley with the Oregon Cultural Trust. Community radio means access to music, news, and programming for everyone. That's why I support KABU with my contribution every year. It's also why I match that gift to the Oregon Cultural Trust. When you make a gift to KABU, make a matching gift to the Cultural Trust by December 31st. Then you can use the cultural tax credit next year to reduce your state tax bill. It's true. And it's also how KABU supporters guarantee access to cultural programming in Portland and all around the state. Visit culturaltrust.org today to learn more before December 31st.
The time is 6:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. The only show of its kind in Oregon or Southwest Washington. I'm Jamie Partridge, and my co-host is Amanda Hill.
Good evening, Jamie.
And tonight we are talking about the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, the Wobblies, 101, Intro 101, and we're here with Sam Scott.
Hello.
And Amanda, you want to kick it off?
Well, Sam, I'm really glad you're here tonight. The IWW is becoming a bit more popular, it seems like, lately. And I'm interested in knowing a little bit about the history of the IWW and let us know why you got involved with it.
Wow. So such a huge history and so very rich. Started in 1905 and was primarily working, you know, in the heavy industries, logging, mining, all of the what we think of as industrial stuff from the early 1900s, was very involved in a lot of different industries. I mean, part of the thing is we are an industrial union. We look at solidarity around across the entire set of industry. Prominent things in the history, you know, over the last 100 years include the Lawrence textile strikes. You can look at a lot of the logging and lumber stuff. There's just so much.
What was special about the Lawrence textile strike?
That was a primarily female-led strike, and at a time where women and immigrants weren't considered worth unionizing, the women and immigrants said, hey, we want to have a voice. And the IWW stepped up to help them have that voice. And the IWW has always kind of said, we all need to be in solidarity. So with that, you also had in 1908, we had Local 8, which was the first longshoreman union that integrated both black and white workers. So we've always kind of been at the forefront of looking to people that, for whatever reason, get overlooked by more traditional business unions.
Well, and at that time, the main union federation was the American Federation of Labor, which was primarily based in the trade unions, which tended to be highly skilled and male and white, and excluded, and in fact, kept their market share by excluding women and people of color and immigrants. The IWW was the alternative, was the industrial
indeed
and union.
Yeah, that's true. The inclusiveness that the IWW has, it's true even to this day. You're organizing around things that the average, what I would like to say, big box union is afraid to organize around.
That is true. And I will say, we like to think of ourselves as inclusive. We know that, you know, just like the working class, any other working class institution, we have a lot of work to do. And I can't speak for the entire union. I can just speak for myself, but I can say that we're doing a really good job of working on those things. We're in Portland, and Portland does not have the best as far as diversity goes anyway. So, you know, we're working on that, and we're figuring out ways to reach out to people of color. We're looking at ways to reach out to gender nonconforming individuals, everybody that doesn't get the highlight, and we're trying to incorporate that into what we're doing now.
That's really awesome.
So when you were established in 1905, I recall the preamble. You might know it by heart.
Pretty close.
Something about the working class and owning class having nothing in common.
Indeed.
You were established as an anti-capitalist union, as a revolutionary union. The idea of all workers should be together in one big union throughout the world, industrial workers of the world.
Correct.
And the weapon for accomplishing the overthrow of capitalism was the general strike.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about some of that stuff?
Yeah. So in capitalism, the only real power that we have as workers is the power of our labor. And the only way we can, ultimately, we can try being nice. We can try talking to our bosses. We can try making very polite requests. And if we wanted to, I suppose we could try to spend time and money and effort going through the courts or going through the legal system, the legislature, to try to get things passed, or we can make a much more direct connection and choose to withhold our labor. That hasn't been the most popular thing throughout the years on kind of some of the AFL-CIO contracts and methods to achieve unionship, but that is kind of what we were founded around, was the idea that we, the workers, we don't need somebody speaking for us. We can do it ourselves. And we don't need somebody acting on our behalf. We can act on our own behalf, which is why we favor doing direct action, whether it's a march on the boss or a strike or, gosh, however creative we want to get.
That's great. Even in my union, which is a more traditional union, the direct action thing is making a comeback. The strike is illegal in a lot of contracts, and illegal in a lot of occupations, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So taking that direct action to the shop floor is really making a big comeback. And I'm excited that a lot of people are choosing to join the IWW as well as their more traditional union. Can you tell us a little bit about the type of people that join the IWW?
Oh, goodness. We have I myself am a member of a traditional business union as well as the IWW. We have people who work in food service. We have people who work in social work. We have people who work in groceries. We have people who work for other unions. We really run the gamut. Gosh, age, gender, occupation, you know, where we fall within the working class financially, it's a very wide spectrum. Here in Portland, we have about 100 members. Of that, probably about half are active on a meaningful way. And it's amazing seeing how that diversity of thought helps to build us into a stronger.
And keeping with that, the voice of the member is really what you're after.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that you do not have paid staff. Your organizers are your members.
Correct. Every anybody who chooses to organize is a leader. And it's to say that we don't have paid staff. We do have some folks who are stipended because their campaign has worked together to build the funds to say, we want you to also be able to survive while you're doing the work of the union. But generally speaking, everybody who does the work is from within the shop that's doing the work or is within the union helping to do that. But they're not getting paid for it. Nobody's career unionists here. It's very much a grassroots organization through and through.
That's awesome.
So I just when you mentioned that people who are dual carters, as mm-hmm. they say, folks who are members of the IWW and a more mainstream union, my past union president, I'm a letter carrier, mm-hmm. Jim Cook, was a dual carter. He was a member of the IWW mm-hmm. and a member of the National Association of Letter Carriers, and actually was our president for, 12 years. And he brought the philosophy of the IWW into our union. That is the organizing on the shop floor. Mm-hmm. Instead of relying on the shop steward, the union representative, to file paper grievances that then get kicked up to step two, to step three, and lost in space for 3 months and maybe traded away for something else, group grievances, group actions, whether as you said, it's a march on the boss, or whether it's a figuring out a way to shame or humiliate the supervisor into doing the right thing, or going around the rules and regulations that we're prohibited by law from slowing down or striking, but working to rule. Mm-hmm. If you follow all the rules directly, yes. For some strange reason, production slows down.
It's so strange that happens, especially when they put so much consideration into those rules.
And then, of course, we're constantly reminding our members that the way that we really advanced as letter carriers was when we had a wildcat illegal strike in 1970, which made tremendous gains in terms of wages, hours, and working conditions. And because we were solid, because we were unified, because we refused to obey the injunctions filed against us, none of us lost our jobs. None of us went to jail. So direct action gets the goods.
Exactly. And it's really important, too, I think, to note that direct action doesn't always look like specific shop floor organizing. Direct action also looks like supportive work. And that's something that we're kind of bringing back to where we are now, is sometimes the work, the direct action that needs to happen isn't necessarily the march on the boss. It's just holding space for each other so that we can vent about what's going on and then determine how to go forward. There's a lot of focus sometimes on the direct action that is directly against the boss, but it's also a sort of direct action to take care of each other. And bringing back some of that care work that gets overlooked a lot of times in big campaigns, we're focusing a lot lately on how can we bring back some of that reproductive labor that needs to get done as well, and how can we help our campaigns to grow, not just in the wages, hours, and conditions, but I guess, it's the roses, not just the bread. Yeah.
The unity of being able to help each other out. We were talking briefly before we started the show around, how grief is handled by the boss versus how grief is handled by our coworkers, and that's just a definite way of showing that the workers are going to get together and really make sure something happens for each other, and the boss typically is not going to do that. They're going to work to rule there.
As in terms of the culture that the IWW has established over the years, music has been a key cohesion and a way of building the confidence and combativeness of IWW members and other workers. And referring back to my past president, Jim Cook, who's a leader and organizer for a local music group called General Strike, which mm-hmm. basically does IWW songs.
Yes.
And, of course, the most famous IWW organizer and musician was Joe Hill.
Of course.
And he was a product of the Northwest IWW organizing and mm-hmm. Did some stuff here in Portland.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of the IWW in Portland, maybe about what they did in the woods or other
kinds
of places?
Well, I mean, it's so I'll admit, there's so much history that I'm not fully versed on all of it. It's just, there's so much. You know, when we look back to the early 1900s, we were doing a lot with the logging industry here in Portland because, you know, that was where the energy was, and that's where the labor was. And so we worked a lot with trying to make sure that people were getting hired and people were getting the positions that they needed. There was a lot of work within the longshoremen to make sure that, you know, everybody was getting hours and it wasn't just the same teams of people getting the hours over and over again. The history, gosh, you can look back at some of the longshoreman strike, and oh gosh, when was that? 29, I want to say. 13? Numbers escape me. But you look back at that, and we were, you know, instrumental in helping to hold that solidarity together while they were trying to work on those wages, hours, and conditions. You know, we sort of disappeared a little bit after, I think, the 40s and 50s, just because the tides of politics change and some of the large...
It's called the McCarthy era.
There is that, yes. You know, and because we were a revolutionary, and we are a revolutionary union, you know, we had a little bit of communist influence and... communists in your executive boards in unions that put us into a little disrepute and disfavor. Mm-hmm. You know, here in Portland about 20 years ago, some folks got together and said we should reestablish a branch and we should really look at what we can do. And, you know, at the beginning of this year, we had our 20-year anniversary for the rechartering of the Portland branch. So,
wow. Awesome. Of course, at the height of the IWW in the Northwest, just after the Russian Revolution of 1917, there was a general strike in the city of Seattle in 1919, which the IWW was at the center of, basically taking over the city for a period of time and running it.
Yes.
Workers running it.
And that general strike was so amazing because it wasn't just the IWW. It was every union. It was the, you know, it was the IWW, but it was also the you know, all of the craft unions, and there were unions specifically for immigrants that were coming out, and they were all getting together and saying, we're going to make the city run regardless of what the boss is. And in that same spirit, I think that we could do with a lot more of that today with, you know,
totally.
the driving force to say we can exist without bosses. And I mean, that's what the IWW was founded on. We're trying to create within this society the seeds for the next society, which is where we have our own control over our own labor. And if anything, the strike of 1919 shows that we can do it. We don't need the bosses dictating what it is that we produce or how we produce it or who we sell it to. We, the workers, can do that ourselves.
I agree. The capitalistic mindset now, they're not interested in actually advancing even the industry that they're working in. They're only interested in advancing their paycheck. And so, yeah, general strike. I'm for that.
Well, as the old wobbly slogan, the boss needs you, you don't need the boss.
Exactly.
If you just tuned in, this is Labor Radio, KBOO Portland, and we're talking about the industrial workers of the world. Intro 101 with Sam Scott. So can you tell us a little bit about what's going on right now in Portland? What are the current campaigns that the IWW are involved with or
that you can talk about?
Different groups of workers who have organized with the Wobblies.
Well, everyone's familiar with the Burgerville Workers Union, and that's affiliated with the IWW. They're fairly autonomous, but we always support every action that they put together. We hold a couple of contracts, one with Janus workers at Janus Youth Programs. And so we're currently going through some renegotiations of the contract there. They had a pretty terrible morale killer in that right before Thanksgiving, one of their programs was shut down. So we did a fundraiser to get some of those workers gift cards for the holidays and try to kind of bring up some of that morale that we had totally in the gutter. It's been a really hard negotiation, and I really can't say more about it, but it's been hard, and we hope to see it coming to an end here soon.
So typically with the IWW, a contract isn't necessarily what your final outcome is going for. How is this campaign with Janice different than other campaigns that don't necessarily go for a contract?
Yeah, so ultimately the union isn't the contract, and it's not what the state defines as a bargaining unit. It's the people on the shop floor. It's two people or more coming together to create better working conditions. And we really try to focus on that because, again, it comes back to that idea that the power comes from the workers, not from some ephemeral piece of paper or legal framework. So the contract is a tool, but we have a really big toolbox. There are shops that would look at, well, they want more direct worker input into how the shop is run. And maybe that's all we need to do. Maybe it's not a long-term, we're going to establish a contract and go for an NLRB election. Maybe we're just going to get the workers what they need, and then we can continue. We certainly hope to bring in all of the workers on the shop floor. We know that that's not always possible. We're still going to work for those workers, and we're still going to do everything we can. But a contract is just one tool in the book. And I think in our perspective generally is that all too often it becomes the focus of what a union is for. Mm-hmm. We're there to renegotiate a contract. We're there to outline specific rules. We're there to negotiate with labor with management as to how labor is going to behave, and that becomes the end of it. And you lose a lot of the militancy on the floor and a lot of enthusiasm for the power that you can hold.
So. I agree with you on the contract not being the end all. At my employer and union relationship, we spend so much time in the grievance process that I feel like a lot of times it weakens our solidarity because we're focusing on individual little pieces instead of working together to go against the boss. The boss is attacking us always through the contract by violating it. So the strength of it is really weakened in that process.
Well, and many unionists, workers, don't know the history of our labor movement before the National Labor Relations Act, or the national, whatever it was called, the first one before that, National Industrial Relations Act. In the 30s, basically unions were not recognized by their employers. They went on strike around whatever grievance that there happened to be. There weren't contracts. The only way they kept their wages up was direct action. Now, the imposition of the collective bargaining, of contracts, was basically for labor peace, to create no strike clauses within contracts that lasted years. And then, of course, a paper grievance procedure, which would dull or lessen the shop floor militancy. And here we're facing a major legal decision, Janice versus AFSCME, that the Supreme Court's going to come down this spring, which is going to cut the legs out from under some of the legal protections that public employee sector unions have had. And particularly around collecting fees, mm-hmm. Fair share collection, dues collection, automatic deduction of dues from paychecks. This is all part of this collective bargaining establishment, which doesn't really impact IWW unionists because you adhere to the old the old traditional way.
We do. And, you know, it's funny. We still put little stamps in paper books at this point. We've modernized here in Portland and can do an electronic funds transfer from your bank account, which is pretty schnazzy. But not everybody in the union can do that.
But it bypasses the employer.
It does. It has absolutely nothing to do with the employer. And, you know, it's a voluntary action that you're taking. It's an intentional action that you're taking. There are people in my union at work, because I am a part of the AFL union in my workplace, who they pay their dues and they don't even care what's happening. They don't notice. And really, it's either, well, pay their dues or pay fair share. And, you know, that's all there is to it. Everybody at the IWW is intentionally an IWW member. People in IWW shops are intentionally putting the effort in, and it just makes for a much stronger. Sometimes it's a little smaller, but it's definitely stronger. And I would rather have five really dedicated people than 100 people who don't care.
Yeah, that's what Janice is going to do. What Janice versus AFSCME, the Supreme Court decision, is going to do is going to continue the law, which requires unions that have representation or recognized representation of the entire workforce, whether people are members or not, but undercutting the security, the union, the requirement that people pay union dues or pay shop fees. With the IWW, you don't have this requirement to represent every worker in the workplace. You represent the people that are members, and
well,
it makes sense. The people who pay dues, the people who are involved, are the people that take care of each other. And if you don't, you're not involved, I'm sorry. You know,
well,
you're not part.
That is a little bit of a misnomer, because
oh, okay.
Where we do have collective bargaining agreements and where we are the exclusive bargaining unit, we represent the entire bargaining unit, whether they're paying dues or fair share or not. So, for example, with our Janus contract, we have a minority presence, but we are representing our entire bargaining unit. But yes, not having fair share or payroll deductions isn't going to affect us at all, because we're used to working on a shoestring. We don't have to pay anybody to do the bargaining, because it's our members doing the bargaining. They're already doing the work. And honestly, you know, we have such low dues anyway, it's just enough to keep the lights on.
Yeah, and what I see happening with the IWW also is that you're organizing as you're collecting dues, because you're doing that stamp, that person is making that intentional donation, where, you know, in a union the size of mine, you know, we've got 4,500 people paying dues, and they're not even thinking about it, like you said, and that's not building solidarity at all.
Exactly.
So, Sam, tell us a little bit about why someone should join up with the IWW, and how people can get in contact with you, how people can be supportive of what the Wobblies are up to in Portland.
Well, you know, getting on any of our mailing lists, if you go to our website, portlandiww.org, we're going to have the contact us box. You can email the secretary directly, secretary@portlandiww.org, and get connected. Delegates will, you know, when our secretary gets an email from somebody who's interested, there are a number of delegates, myself included, who will have that passed on to us, and then we'll set up a time to have kind of a one-on-one meeting and see if that's see what it is that's drawing you to the IWW. We really do try to keep it revolutionary, and we really do try to keep it. We keep some idealism in what we're doing. It's important to note that we're not a political organization. We very strictly adhere to the idea that we don't have politics involved in our unionizing. So
you don't endorse political candidates for office?
Absolutely not. And we don't have a political view. I mean, we have a revolutionary view, which I guess you could argue is political, but we don't have, you know, we are not a democratic organization. We're not a...
You mean like a Democratic party
Democratic
organization.
Party organization. We're
Democrat
not,
with a small d.
Yes. Yeah. We are very much a democratic organization. Everybody gets a vote, and everything that we do is based on what people within the union want to do. But if you're interested in getting involved in a place where people are excited to see shop floor mobilization, if you're excited to help build that solidarity among the working class, not just at your job site, but across multiple job sites. You know, that is what brought me to the IWW, and I would certainly encourage anybody else to get involved as well.
Thank you, Sam Scott. And that wraps it up for Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. Thanks to my co-host, Amanda Hill. This is Jamie Partridge, and thanks to our engineer, Danielle Parks. Good night.
And thanks for listening to us on Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Tune into Cable every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand.